From NPR and Chicago Public Radio, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Carl Castle, and here's your host at the Brown Theater at the Wortham Center in Houston, Texas, Peter Sagal.
Thank you, Carl. Thank you, everybody. Thank you. Thank you, Houston. Yeah, it is kind of exciting, isn't it? Hey, I got a question. Does anybody remember money? You know, it was these green pieces of paper. We used it to buy things before the financial collapse reduced us to an economic system based on bartering seashells and mutual grooming behaviors. Anyway, this week, we are devoting our entire show to the theme of money. Who had it, what they did with it, and what people might do to get it. And two members of the great Texas rock band ZZ Top, Dusty Hill and Billy Gibbons, will be here to give us some lessons about living large. First, it's your turn, and it's free to call 1-888-WAIT-WAIT. That's 1-888-924-8924. It's time to welcome our first listener contestant. Hi, you're on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Hi there, this is Jordan Deckenbach from Washington, D.C.
Hey, Jordan. What do you do there in Washington?
I'm an attorney.
Ah.
What a surprise, right?
I see. There are so many of you in Washington. Do you ever move about in great herds?
We do. It's how we prefer to travel.
Yeah. Well, welcome to the show, Jordan. Let me introduce you to our panel this week. First, say hello to a humorist and author of the audiobook, It's Just Like I Told You, 25 years of comments and comic pieces available to download near you, Mr. Tom Baudet.
Hello, Jordan.
Hey, Tom.
Next, say hello to a comedian whose first CD, I Heart Jokes, is out now, Ms. Paula Poundstone.
Hey, Jordan.
And lastly, a deputy editor and blogger for the Houston Chronicle, Houston's own, Kiri O'Connor.
Hi, Jordan.
Hey there.
Jordan, welcome to the show. Now, as I said, the theme of this week's show is money, and we're going to ask you to play a new game we've invented for the occasion, and we're calling it
Lifestyles of the Rich and Despicable.
All right.
You're a lawyer. You know all over this stuff. You're good.
D.C., we're full of those.
Yeah. Well, never have so few made so much money wrecking the economy as in 2008. We're going to give you clues as to how three financial tycoons were amusing themselves while you and I were fighting the other hobos for that last can of beans. Your job is to guess correctly what they were doing. Do that two times out of three. You'll win Carl's voice in your home answering machine. Ready to play?
Let's do it.
Well, we'll start with one of the first companies to collapse causing that crisis. We're talking about the investment bank Bear Stearns. Carl, tell us about their CEO, James Cain.
Well, this tycoon takes his pleasures at the table. He's not eating. He's playing. And after trumping his opponents, he likes to kick back, turn on the blacklight poster, and play a hand or two with a bridge partner named Mary Jane.
Turns out, according to the Wall Street Journal anyway, that Mr. Cain may not have noticed his bank was imploding because he was too busy playing bridge and doing what?
Smoking weed.
You bet. Looking back on it, Bear Stearns never should have done their executive recruiting from the guys selling bootlegs outside a Grateful Dead concert. Before he became a multimillionaire titan of finance, Mr. Cain was a competitive bridge player, and even as his company lost billions of dollars, he still found time to play at tournaments, disappearing for days or weeks at a time during crises. And, the journal said, many people saw the 60-something Cain light up a doobie after a hard day at the table. He denied one specific allegation, but when pressed if he ever indulged, he said, "Whoa, man, you've got a real questiony aura."
You know, the story about him smoking dope is actually kind of reassuring, because when you look at that mess, these people are educated, experienced, and all that, just completely drive this thing into the ground. And it's somehow comforting to think that maybe they were just stoned.
Yeah. It's like
that it wasn't malice, it wasn't greed, it was just pure dope-headedness.
Like buying up all those troubled assets, it was just a form of the financial munchies. Oh, dude, I could eat a whole bag of subprime loans right now. All right, Jordan, that was very good. Now, the next to fall as the economy imploded was the nearly century-old investment bank Merrill Lynch, whose demise as an independent company was overseen by its CEO, one John Thame. Carl, tell us about Mr. Thame.
Well, Peter, he's not the kind of guy to let the collapse of the American financial system get him down. He's got an $80,000 couch made from real unicorn leather. And a Queen Anne chair made from Queen Anne.
Thame became infamous because while his bank was going under, he spent $1.2 million of company money doing what?
Redecorating his office.
Exactly right. Everybody knows, it's a truism in business, you can't destroy one of the significant institutions of Wall Street while sitting behind a déclassé desk. John Thame was the highest paid executive in America. He earned $82 million a year, yet he submitted more than $1 million of receipts for furniture for reimbursement. A few months later, Merrill had been bought by Bank of America and absorbed $20 billion in taxpayer bailout money. To Mr. Thame's credit, he did say he did have a regret about the whole thing. He said, quote, "If I had that to do over again, I'd furnish it in IKEA."
You know, I have a whole theory about the Merrill Lynch problem.
Yeah.
Remember back in the day, they used to be Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner, and Smith?
Mm-hmm.
I think Pierce, Fenner, and Smith were the smart guys.
Yeah, whatever happened to them? All right, Jordan, one more to go. One of the most notorious failed companies of the crisis was AIG, the insurance giant that ended up being bailed out to the tune of $100 billion or more of our money. It ran through CEOs during the crisis like it did taxpayer cash, and Carl is going to tell you about the last of them.
The new CEO of AIG works hard and plays hard. Actually, we're not sure if he works hard. He doesn't care about the S&P 500. He wants SPF 30.
So what was the first bold move Robert Benmosche took after taking over troubled AIG in the summer of 2009?
Took a trip to somewhere warm, I'm guessing the Bahamas?
Well, close enough. He went on vacation immediately. So imagine your team's losing big in the late innings, and you call in your star closer, and he runs out onto the field right past the mound to the concession stand for some nachos. Robert Benmosche offered the excuse that he'd been planning the trip for a while, and sure, the company had just been given billions of dollars in U.S. taxpayer funds, but Carnival Cruises offers an endless chocolate fountain at the dessert buffet. Once he got back from his trip, Benmosche announced that the bonuses that were still being given to AIG executives were, quote, criminal. No, wait, he didn't say that. He said the bonuses were fine. Telling people about them was criminal.
Well, you know, the poor guy, he was CEO of AIG. If you've got that many letters, you're doing something wrong.
That's true.
You should have a word in there somewhere.
Yeah, CEO.
OMG. Carl, how did Jordan do in our quiz?
Well, Jordan is a winner, Peter. He had three correct answers, so I'll be doing the message on his home answering machine.
Well done, Jordan. Thank Congratulations.
You.
Right now, panel, it's time for you to answer some questions. All of your questions this week are about money, of course. Yes. Tom, AIG had it tough last year, as we have discussed. It seemed everybody hated them. They did find support, though, from one unlikely group. Who was it?
Unlikely group, AIG. Can I have a hint?
Well, I mean, it's like, hey, you're not getting a bonus this year, but you are getting a wonderful picture made with macaroni. Who makes little pictures with macaroni noodles?
Well, little kids.
Exactly.
Little kids supported AIG?
Yes, and in fact, it was a particular...
Because they can spell it?
It was a class... Yeah. We wanted to send letters to Merrill Lynch, but we couldn't handle it, so AIG. And it was a class of fourth graders, in fact, from around here, when a Houston area teacher, Rebecca Chapman, asked her students what it might feel like to be an AIG employee when everybody was so mad at them. One boy asked, can we write them and let them know it's going to be okay? And the whole class got in on it. Sample notes to AIG, quote, hi, AIG, not all of USA hate you, unquote. Quote, keep working hard, dudes. Keep eating your vegetables. One AIG employee, so touched by this, wrote back to the students and said, quote, "To have reached out to us in such a heartfelt way is really a testament to your individual and collective humanity," unquote, showing he knew about as much about talking to kids as he did about the difference between right and wrong.
Wait a minute. What grade was this again?
The fourth grade.
Now, okay, what fourth grade teacher talks to their kids about AIG?
Maybe someone who had invested a lot of money. Miss Smithers, why are you weeping?
Well,
why are you drinking out of that bottle all the time?
What a weird thing. I just think that there's other things that they needed to get going on, like mathematical skills, perhaps.
So they don't end up like executives at AIG.
Right.
Precisely.
Thanks, everybody. Thank you all. Right now it's time for the Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me Bluff the Listener game. Call 1-888-WAIT-WAIT to play our game in the air. Hi, you're on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Hi, this is Amy in Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
Hey, Lancaster, that's Amish country, is it not?
It is, it is.
I'm assuming you're not Amish because you're on the phone and listening to the radio.
Although rumor has it that they do have phones, but they're in the barn.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You think they're sneaking out to the barn to call into quiz shows?
Yeah.
Well, welcome to our show, Amy. You're going to play the game in which you must try to tell truth from fiction. Carl, what is Amy's topic?
It's not easy having green.
It's great to be rich, but the rich have their crosses to bear. And it's even worse for them because their crosses are made of solid gold and they're heavier. Our panelists are going to read you three stories about hardships for the rich, only one of which is true. Pick the real story, and you'll win Carl's voice on your home answering machine. Ready to play?
Yep.
First, let's hear from Tom Baudet.
The rich aren't like you and me, declared Fitzgerald. And one might add, they don't like you and me either. They don't want us dropping by their secured houses, bumping into us at airports, or, it seems, even mingling data with our kind online. A new wave of exclusive social networking sites are being billed as safe havens for the affluent to flirt, swap fencing club advice, and find new pals without dealing with the Facebook, MySpace, hoi polloi. How's it working out? Well, it seems you and me can lie about how much money we have and join right in the fun. A smallworld.net, one of the leading snob sites, feels a whole lot smaller to many of its users since you and me figured out how to cross the velvet cyber rope. One member complained, quote, "In the real world, we are each discerning about who we make friends with. There is no reason why, when we come online, we should have to socialize with truck drivers from hick parts of the USA."
The rich members of social networking sites for rich people getting upset because of all the not rich people who are showing up. Your next story of how money can't buy everything comes from Kiri O'Connor.
Lady Genevieve Mimsheit loved the unspoiled village of Prinza, tucked in a valley in the Dolomites. So Lady Genevieve bought a villa on a hill overlooking the village, which is known for its goat cheese. It was lovely for a year or so, until several of Lady Jen's rich friends also built estates nearby. Then they all hired the goat herders as groundskeepers, personal assistants, and chauffeurs. The village got boutiques. The villagers were ecstatic. "We liked the Starbucks and the Burberries. We hated the goats," said one. But Lady Genevieve is devastated. "It's ruined, I say. All this beastly bettering of oneself is so unseemly."
A rich lady ruins a village because she bought property there. Your last story of trouble for the rich comes from Paula Poundstone.
Often forgotten during economic tough times are the feelings of the rich. The constant focus of the media and politicians on the woes of the low-income and impoverished can be emotionally devastating to the haves. The effects of the depression among the upper classes is pulling test scores down at exclusive private schools, and gated communities are feeling more isolated than they originally intended to be. "My father happens to make a lot of money," says teenage heiress Asia Wingate. "But, like, I'm still an American, aren't I? My friends in France and Switzerland certainly think so." Fortunately for the downtrodden rich, there are some resources, like psychologist Renee McCraw, who facilitates surprisingly effective support groups where clients play Monopoly in life with $1,000 less starting money than the rules require. Many of the affluent are suffering terribly emotionally from not suffering at all monetarily, says McCraw. Fortunately, their houses are big, so they can be apart fairly easily, and the summer homes help.
All right. Let's review your choices. From Tom Baudet, you heard a story about members of social networking sites exclusively for the rich are getting upset because poor people are sneaking in. From Kiri O'Connor, the story of a very miserable wealthy lady who is upset that the beautiful little village didn't say the same after she bought her villa there. Or from Paula Poundstone, the story of a new terrible problem for the rich, depression for being wealthy in poor times. Which of these is the real story of how even the most affluent still have problems?
Well, I think they all kind of sound possible, but I'm going to go with Carrie's.
You're going to go with Carrie's story?
Yeah.
About the lady who bought the villa in the beautiful village and it got ruined because all her friends bought into and now no one will herd the goats that she loved so much.
Yeah.
All right. Your story is Kira's. Well, we actually have somebody who is affected by this problem to bring you the real story.
A small world is the only true online networking community of well-connected people linked together through the desire to live a lavish lifestyle.
That was a young woman named Eva Marin. She is a member of a smallworld.net, which is one of the sites which is being infiltrated by us poor people. So I'm so sorry, as you have no doubt figured out, the real story was from Tom. You didn't win, but you did earn a point for Kiri for her remarkable and sad story of
Thank
the
you.
Ruined village in the Dolomites.
You're
Thank
welcome.
You so much for playing.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
What else do the simple folk do to perk up the heart and get through? The wee folk and the grown folk who wander to and fro have ways known to their own folk.
And now the game where we ask people who've done a lot to do one more thing. We ask them to play a game called Not My Job. So a long while ago, I was a teenager in New Jersey watching MTV, and on came these videos of these three guys in sunglasses, two of them with amazing beards, and they were playing hard-driving blues rock, and they were sort of supervising as these custom dragsters delivered gorgeous models around to solve guys' problems. And I said to myself, man, have I got to get to Texas. It took me a while. Here I am, though. Here they are. We are joined now by Rock and Roll Hall of Famers Dusty Hill and Billy Gibbons, better known as two-thirds of the band ZZ Top. Dusty and Billy, welcome to Wait, Wait.
Amen. Thank you.
All right. Let's establish some things. You, of course, are two of the three members of the band. The third, of course, is the drummer, Frank Beard, who, of course, is the only one without a beard.
Of course.
So we'll start right in with the beards. You both have very long beards that everybody has seen from your many videos in the 80s and later. Was that something that just happened that you said, oh, let's grow long beards? Was it like an intentional decision for the look? Or
we were on the road for over 300 days a year for a year, so finally we took what we thought was about 3 or 4 months off, and it turned into a lot longer. And we traveled independently, and we talked on the telephone, but not in person. So I just let my beard grow because I didn't care. And evidently Billy did too, but it did not come up in conversation.
Right.
So
neither of you said, hey, why does your voice sound weirdly muffled lately?
Yeah. Exactly, and we wouldn't answer that anyway.
Yeah.
But anyway, when we got together for rehearsals, Billy's beard was considerably longer, so was mine, and Frank's beard had just shaved. So you read into that whatever you want.
But, I understand.
That was just an accident. But when we started later doing videos and whatnot, I mean, we weren't exactly a long hair, pretty group. So we kind of went that way.
Well, that's what I loved about you guys when I first saw your music on videos.
You don't think I'm pretty?
I think you're gorgeous.
Yeah, okay.
But I felt kind of shy about that. Because we're watching MTV in the first days of MTV, and he had all these pretty boys with no talent like Billy Idol and all those guys. Ooh. Yeah, I said that.
Ooh.
And then you.
Oh, yeah.
Ooh. And then you guys showed up, and you guys did not look like that. You were not a hair band. You were not, you know, pretty
well,
models.
Well, we were hair band.
You were hair band, but more in the front. And did any music executive say to you guys, well, look, this is music videos. People can see you. This look is not going to work. You have to change.
We didn't talk a lot to those guys.
Really?
No.
This was totally cool?
Yeah.
Well, since that became your look, though, has it become a burden? Now you have to have the beards.
It's good in winter. It's a drag in the summer.
I can imagine. I imagine during the summers here, like, birds must nest in there. It's just a hive.
Aren't you glad that when you worked separately and you talked to each other on the phone, that the thing that you hadn't both gotten really, really fat?
Yeah.
And then you came back and you were like, oh, it's the big, huge fat guys. And then you had to stay fat forever.
Well, that we would have had to go in a different direction with the videos.
That's true. And you also are known for your collection of custom cars, a couple of which used to appear in your videos back when.
Yeah.
Famously, the Eliminator.
The Eliminator, and Cadzilla.
Cadzilla, which was a customized Cadillac.
Still have them. Still going strong. We don't drive.
You don't drive?
The girls got to drive them.
Why don't you drive?
Would you insure us?
Yeah.
So you just commission them sometimes? You commission them made from custom car makers?
Well, with girls at the wheel, I mean.
Do they come with the girls? Is that extra? I'd like chrome, a deep red finish. And do you name them? Are you the guy who says, we should call this? Not the girls. The girls presumably come with names. Like, who named the Leapin' Limo, for example?
We knew a girl named Leapin' Lena.
Oh, really? He said, walking right into it. Why did they call her that?
Well, you know, limo's long and never mind.
Never mind.
Do you think that was her given name?
Somebody gave it to her.
Yeah, and for a good reason. So you guys going to keep playing? I know you have a new record coming out. You're working with Rick Rubin, right?
Right.
The great producer. Did he come to you with a particular spin on the music you've done? Or is it just he loved you guys and wanted to do your next record?
Well, he was very instrumental in retaining the essence of the band. We are three guys. We know three chords.
One each. That works out nicely.
Rick was very, very quick to say, listen, let's keep the real ZZ as we know and love. And I said, well, how about the modern aspects of it? And he said, no. He said, let's not get too modern. He said that, of course, as he was speaking to us over the laptop Macintosh computer, having a BlackBerry.
Yes.
And programming the GPS.
Right. He said
that. So it can go any number of ways. We're just having a great time, as we always do.
We talked to some friends of ours here in Houston, and they say that anybody here in Houston, if they've lived long enough, has a ZZ Top story. Like when they were a kid, they mowed your lawn, or like you played at their friend's wedding. Is that true? Do you guys like just hang out in the community? You know, like the rock stars next door?
Well, I don't stay inside all the time. I mean.
No. Do you get attention, untoward attention? Is it tough for you to walk around? Or are people in Houston totally cool with you guys?
Well, if they have a bad story, I just say, I'm Billy. if it's good, it's me.
Yes. That could work.
Yeah.
Well, Billy and Dusty, we are so delighted to have you with us. We have asked you here to play a game that this time we're calling...
You pinch those pennies so hard, they scream for mercy.
Hetty Green. She was known as the Witch of Wall Street. She was one of the greatest misers who ever lived. By the time she died in 1916, she was a billionaire by today's measure, but she was famous for never parting with a nickel if she could help it. We're going to ask you three questions about Hetty Green. Get two right, you'll win our prize for one of our listeners, Carl's voice in their home answering machine. Carl, who is ZZ Top playing for?
Lenny Ambrose of Houston.
There you go. He's out there. He's a neighbor. He's a friend. Ready to play that? You ever heard of Hetty Green? She was famous once upon a time.
Wrote a song about her, but we hadn't quite got it together yet.
I understand. Okay. Here's your first question. Hetty Green once stayed up half the night searching for something she lost. Was it A, a 2-cent postage stamp? B, part of a ham sandwich she had brought home from a restaurant 2 days before? or see a soiled napkin she had been carrying for 6 months that she said, hey, had plenty of life left in it. They're consulting.
Yeah.
They're leaning towards each other.
We'll go with A.
You can go with A, the postage stamp.
Stamp.
The
one A.
You're right.
Yes. Hey,
that was great. That was well done. Yeah? By the way, she would never be so profligate as to buy a sandwich at a restaurant. Her lunch every day was dry oatmeal at her desk.
Oh, right. I knew that one.
You knew that. Okay, damn. Oh, you're all ready for that. All right. Here's your next question. Hetty refused to spend money on her physical appearance. Which of these tales of her legendary penny-pinching about clothes is true? A, she instructed her laundry only to wash the dirtiest portion of her skirt, the hem, in order to save money on soap. B, she had her summer dress made of old burlap sacks. Or C, after finding out how much shampoo cost, she shaved her hair off and got a wig.
I don't think she'd spend money on the laundry.
It's definitely
so B.
That's definitely B, that she made dresses out of burlap sacks.
Is
that
your choice? B.
No, it's not. It was actually A.
Well,
she
A.
told her laundress just to wash the hems, save money on soap. That's okay.
She had a laundress?
She had a
laundress.
Well, you know. People did
like, do you have a closet?
Do I have a closet?
No, that's an old joke. You know, no.
Basically, I am coming to the understanding that I never understood a word you guys said for the entire time I was listening. All right, here we go. Here's your last question. You get this one right, you win it all. I can tell you're up for it. Here we go. Hetty Green's son became known as Colonel Ned Green. He spent his life happily squandering his mother's fortune. Among his many, many purchases was which one-of-a-kind of extravagance? A custom-made miniature submarine for his swimming pool. B, a diamond-encrusted chamber pot. Or C, a private gladiatorial arena.
Man.
Are there one of those things you guys don't have?
The gladiatorial thing.
I was just thinking how I needed a gladiatorial.
No, I'm going to update my chamber pot.
I'm going B.
You're going to go B?
B.
Yeah.
The diamond-encrusted chamber pot?
Yeah.
You're right!
Hey, now.
Well done! They did it! Carl, how did Billy and Dusty do in our quiz?
Well, they had two correct answers, Peter. That's good enough to win for Lenny Ambrose. Congratulations.
Well
guys.
Done. Dusty Hill plays bass. Billy Gibbons plays guitar for the greatest rock band to ever come out of Texas, ZZ Top. Dusty and Billy, thank you so much for being here with us. In just a minute, Carl Nichols and rhymes you down to nothing in our Listener Limerick Challenge. If you'd like to play, give us a call at 1-888-WAIT-WAIT. That's 1-888-924-8924. Right now, panel, some more questions for you. And again, they're all about money. Paula, you think Wall Streeters live in excess, but they've got nothing on Madame de Poitiers, a mistress of the French King Henry II, back from the 16th century. Recently, a medical journal revealed that she died from drinking what?
Honey?
No.
What did she drink? Coins.
You're getting close.
Liquid gold.
Yes. All the time, apparently.
Oh, wow. Man. You can only have a little bit of that stuff.
Oh, yeah. French experts came to the conclusion that Diane de Poitiers died of gold poisoning. They dug her up, and they found high levels of gold in her hair, and there's really no way for it to get there but from the inside.
Wow.
Apparently, people at the time thought drinking gold kept you young, which is only true in the sense that you stop aging when you die. Kiri, the name Enron, maybe you've heard of it. has become synonymous with corporate misdeeds, greed, and fraud. But the company nearly had another name to begin with. It was Enteron. Until somebody pointed out that wasn't such a great idea. What was the problem with the name Enteron?
Enteron?
Mm-hmm.
It sounded like something else.
It didn't sound something else. It meant something.
Enteron, it meant something in a different language
it
that was
did.
Nasty.
It did. Well, an entrepreneurial company is supposed to have guts, but maybe not so literally.
It means intestines.
It does, in Greek. Enteron means intestines in Greek. One day in the mid-1980s, an energy executive named Ken Lay dreamed of creating a new company to dominate all areas of energy production and training, and he named that company Enteron. He even printed up business cards and commissioned a logo before somebody looked it up. Turns out he has even fewer skills in naming than he does in bookkeeping. Really, though, it seemed appropriate because they actually used goat entrails to make their profit projections, so it all worked out in the end. They shortened it to Enron, a word which now stands for what comes out of intestines. Tom, a pharmaceutical company is offering 1,000 people an all-expenses-paid vacation to Mexico. There's just one little catch. They want you to do what?
Catch something.
Yes.
Drink the water.
Exactly right. Pack your bikini and some sunscreen. The Austrian pharmaceutical company Intercell is sending you to Mexico. All you have to do is take a relatively untested diarrhea drug with potentially harmful side effects. Fun will begin as soon as you arrive when a concierge greets you and whisks you off to a sunny clinic where they take your first blood sample and give you your very own stool diary.
What's the name of the company?
It's called Intercell.
They should have used Enteron.
Enteron.
Yeah, I know. It would work for them.
It's available.
Way down here, you need a reason to move. Feel a fool, running your stateside games. Lose your load, leave your mind behind, baby Jane. Oh, Mexico, you sound so simple, I just got to go. The sun's so hot, I forgot to go home. Guess I'll have to go now.
Coming up, it's lightning fill in the blank, but first it's the game where you have to listen for the rhyme. If you'd like to play on air, call or leave a message at 1-888-WAIT-WAIT. That's 1-888-924-8924. Hi, you're on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Hi, Peter. It's Liz from Kings Point, New York.
Kings Point, New York. That's near New York City. What do you do there?
I'm a writer.
Well, what do you write?
Right now, I am writing the thing that has been the most fun of all of the things I've done in my life.
Yeah.
I am a ghostwriter who meets with a funeral director in the cemetery office every week, and we are producing a book about the funeral industry in and about New York City for the last 40 years.
You're writing a lighthearted look. The laughs, the cheerful good times of the funeral industry.
That's correct.
I think that's a great idea, and I think you'll sell a million copies. Well, welcome to the show. Carl Castle is going to read you 3 economics-themed limericks with the last word or phrase missing from each. If you can fill in that last word or phrase correctly, then the 2 of the limericks will be a winner. All of your limericks are about odd theories in economics, all right? Here is your first limerick.
As economies are more distraught, actors work where the food's made and brought. Who cares about cooking when the busboy is good-looking? Things are bad when the waitstaff is...
fraught?
Fraught? Oh, my God, they're so upset. I don't know what's going on. They're not fraught. It's a bit of a tricky rhyme. We'll hear the limerick one more time.
Okay.
As economies are more distraught, actors work where the food's made and brought. Who cares about cooking when the busboy is good-looking? Things are bad when the waitstaff is...
caught?
No. When the busboy is good looking, a synonym for good looking might be. I can tell not only you're not going to get it, you're going to be mad when I tell it to you.
You're absolutely correct.
If you were looking at Peter right now, it would be a helpful clue.
Oh, thank you.
Well, now let me think about that one.
No, the answer is
hot.
Yes, hot. There you go. You got it.
guys, you had to have an accent to get that right.
Yeah, it's true. Imagine a New York accent. More distraught, though hot, you know. It's widely known that economists use some pretty wacky indexes to measure the financial climate. And one of them is the hot waitress index, known to economists. That shows that the tougher the times, the hotter the waitresses. Would-be models and actresses can't get high-paying modeling and acting jobs, so they end up in the service industry. That's how you can tell. Now, this would be actually one of the bright spots in the recession if any of us could afford to go to a restaurant. All right, very good. Here is your next limerick.
Men think marriage will be a big laugh. Men think wheat, but the women think chaff. Men say, oh, honey, it's worth lots of money. But women cut that down by...
half.
Right. Very well done. There's a new study out that tries to put a financial value on the emotional benefits of matrimony. It claims marriage brings approximately $30,000 worth of happiness to men, but just half of that to women. On the other hand, when it comes to divorce, men feel approximately $100,000 worth of misery, whereas women feel a measly $7,000 of sad. However, you'll be happy to know that in most settlements, she ends up getting at least half of his misery. All right, very good. Here is your last limerick, Liz.
No ring's been bought by my fiancé, and when we'll get hitched, well, he can't say. He feels strapped for cash, 'cause the markets might crash when there's number one hits by...
Beyoncé.
Yes! Beyoncé. Beyoncé's monster hit single, Single Ladies... Maybe good news for you, it's disaster for the rest of us financially. That is the theory of a professor of finance at NYU. He says that he looked, and in any era, if the hit songs in the Billboard chart have a steady beat, the market, by contrast, is turbulent and eventually crashes. Single Ladies, a strong, steady beat. So we're doomed. That's what he says. He doesn't know if this is cause and effect, but he does point out that the number one song in the fall of 1929 was by a band called Leaky Faucet and the Metronomes.
And then, you know, the bigger worry for me is these studies progress and they kind of are zeroing in on these indicators that they're going to get to me and realize that I can destroy a perfectly healthy corporation by buying two of their stocks.
Really?
Yeah. I could be used as a weapon of economic destruction.
Carl, how did Liz do in our quiz?
Three correct answers, Peter. So,
well
Liz,
done.
You win our prize.
Congratulations. Bye-bye now.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Now it's time to move on to our final game, Lightning Fill-in-the-Blank. Each of our players will have 60 seconds in which to answer as many fill-in-the-blank questions as he or she can. Each correct answer is now worth 2 points. Carl, can you give us the scores?
Tom Beaudet and Kerry O'Connor each has 3 points. They have the lead. Paula Poundstone has 2 points.
All right. Paula, you're in third place. You're up first. Now, all of your questions are going to be about fictional tycoons and millionaires. The clock will start when I begin your first question. Fill in the blank. More than 83 million people tuned in to find out who shot oil baron J.R. Ewing on the TV show Blank.
Jowls.
Right. In the months before its publication, F. Scott Fitzgerald repeatedly tried to change the title of his book about a Long Island millionaire, Blank.
The Great Gatsby.
Right. Detective Comics number 27, The Case of the Chemical Syndicate, was the first story featuring millionaire Bruce Wayne as his alter ego, Blank.
Batman.
Right. In December 2009, Montgomery Burns, owner of the Springfield Nuclear Power Plant on Blank, received 27 write-in votes in the New York mayoral election.
The nuclear power plant on Dubai. I don't know.
No, on The Simpsons. On The Simpsons.
I've never seen The Simpsons.
It's quite good. You should give it a try. Superman's millionaire nemesis Lex Luthor went through a major change in his fourth appearance on the comic strip because Blank.
He went through a major change because he had gone through surgery.
No, because the artist made a mistake and made him completely bald, which he remains to this day. Tom Wolfe's novel about millionaire bond trader Sherman McCoy, titled Blank, was originally published as a serial in Rolling Stone magazine.
Bonfire of the... Vanities.
Bonfire of the Vanities, yes. In 2002, Dutch artist Mats Gilkstad built a life-size scale model of the money vault owned by the world's richest duck, blank.
Scrooge McDuck.
Right. After his exile from the Philippines, real-life millionaire dictator Ferdinand Marcos considered taking up residence on blank.
Mars.
No, on Gilligan's Island.
Oh.
We don't know whether the island millionaire Thurston Howell III would have welcomed Ferdinand and Imelda with open arms, but the mayor of Honolulu thought that the real-life island that they used as a location for Gilligan's Island would have been perfect for the couple in exile. The Marcoses never took up residence, though, because Imelda did not like the professor's coconut shoes. Carl, how did Paula do in our quiz?
Paula had 5 correct answers for 10 more points. She now has 12 points, and Paula has the lead.
All right. Very well done, Paula. Nicely done.
Because I know a lot about money.
You sure do. We flipped a coin. Kiri has elected to go second. Here we go. All of your questions are about commercial slogans and catchphrases.
Oh, okay.
Here we go. With his catchphrase, "They're great," Tony the Tiger beat out challengers Katie the Kangaroo, Elmo the Elephant, and Newt the Nude to become the mascot of blank.
Frosted Flakes?
Kellogg's Frosted Flakes. 81-year-old Clara Peller was rocketed to stardom in 1984 when she said blank in a Wendy's commercial.
Where's the beef?
Right. In commercials, Timex put its watches through torture tests to prove the truth of their slogan blank.
It takes a lick and it keeps on ticking.
Right. Because it was so successful, Sammy Davis Jr. recorded 2 versions of Alka-Seltzer's jingle with the catchphrase blank.
Is that the plop, plop, fizz, fizz?
It was. Oh, KFC's slogan, "Finger Lickin' Good," did not translate well in Chinese, where the literal version was blank.
You'll eat your fingers?
Yes, eat your fingers off. To soften their image and encourage people to make long-distance calls, in 1979, AT&T debuted the slogan blank.
Call your mother.
Reach out and touch someone. Kurt Vonnegut wrote that he did not mean to indicate an association with General Mills or Wheaties when he titled his novel blank.
Breakfast of Champions.
Right. In a commercial for Nike, instead of saying their slogan, "Just Do It," a member of Kenya's Samburu tribe actually said blank in his native tongue.
Let's get it on.
No, he said, "I don't want these. Give me big shoes." The commercial shows Samburu tribesmen running, then pans down to show they're wearing Nike running shoes. One speaks to the camera in his own language, and while the subtitle says, "Just Do It," he just said something else entirely. Carl, how did Kiri do in our quiz?
Kiri had 6 correct answers for 12 more points. She now has 15 points, and Kiri has taken the lead.
Well done. All right. How many, then, does Tom need to win?
6 to tie, 7 to win outright.
All right, well done. Tom, all of your questions are about shopping.
Oh, can we go more
too late.
Taglines?
Nope.
I know taglines.
The questions are about shopping. Fill in the blank, this is for the game. With 2.5 million square feet of retail space, the blank in Minnesota has 520 stores and a theme park.
Mall of America.
Right. Entrepreneur A.J. Kubani changed direct sales forever by tagging his products with the logo proclaiming they were as seen on blank.
TV.
Right. Gravity Defier shoes and gold-dipped roses are just 2 of the items passengers on domestic flights can find in the blank catalog.
Oh, the Sky Mall.
Right. His infomercials for the Pocket Fisherman and Ginsu Knives catapulted blank and his company Ronco to fame.
Oh, what's that guy's name? I don't know. Captain Kangaroo.
Ron Popeil. In 2006, Star Trek actor William Shatner sold his blank to raise money for Habitat for Humanity.
His toupee.
His kidney stone. Since 1952, the luxury department store blank has issued its annual Christmas book catalog of extravagant fantasy gifts.
Who is that? They always have like a $60,000 car, and it is... Go ahead. I've already lost.
It's Neiman Marcus. The popularity of shopping online led the National Retail Federation to name the Monday after Thanksgiving blank.
Black Monday.
Cyber Monday. While demonstrating how fun and easy it is to use the Wii tennis game, a home shopping network host accidentally blanked.
Threw it through the television.
Exactly
screen.
Right. The Wiimote tennis attachment flew off the remote, smashed the screen, and broke it. The host continued on, but Home Shopping Network executives were not amused and said that the incident marked John McEnroe's last day as a host. Carl, did Tom do well enough to win?
Well, Tom needed at least 6 to tie, but Tom had just 4 correct answers. So with 15 points, Kerry O'Connor
of Houston, Texas, is the champion. In just a minute, we'll ask our panelists what will cause the next financial crisis. But first, let me tell you that support for NPR comes from NPR stations. the National Association of Realtors, providing information about the Home Buyer Tax Credit at houselogic.com/homebuyertaxcredit. The Avis Family Foundation, supporting expanded foreign news online and on air. And LendingTree, whose financial tools include Loan Coach, offering personalized advice for every step of the lending process at LendingTree.com. Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is a production of NPR and Chicago Public Radio in association with Urgent Haircut Productions. Doug Berman, executive producer. Philip Goedeker writes our limericks. Our intern is Christine Fiedler. Our web guru is Beth Novi. Special thanks to Woody Freitag and the crew at the Brown Theater in Houston. BJ Liederman composed our theme. Our program is produced by Ian Chillog, Eva Walchover, and Emily Ecton, with special help this week from Tricia McKinney. Technical direction from Robert Newhouse and Lorna White. The senior producer of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is Mike Danforth. Now, panel, what will bring on the next financial crisis? Kerry O'Connor.
Bloated pharmaceutical companies will collapse when people decide to actually try diet and exercise.
Good work. Tom Baudet.
Due to the recent Supreme Court ruling, corporations will pour so much money into political campaigns, they'll go belly up by the hundreds.
And Paula Poundstone.
The overinflated value of William Shatner's kidney stones.
And if any of those things happen, panel, we'll ask you about it on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Thank you, Carl Castle. Thanks also to Paula Poundstone, Kerry O'Connor, Tom Baudet. Thanks to Deborah Fraser and everyone at KUHF. Thanks to Lane Twining, Virginia Oxford, and the staff at the Wortham Center. Thanks to Holly Clapham and Lindsey Brown at the GHCVB. Thanks to all our wonderful audience here at the Brown Theater in Houston, Texas. Thanks to all of you for listening. I am Peter Sagal. We will see you next week. This is NPR.